Good afternoon. So, do we have an actual, okay, maybe. So last time, we introduced the POSIX threading API, known as pthreads. We saw our equivalence to the functions we saw with processes. So our closest equivalent to fork is pthread create. Unlike fork, it doesn't return twice. It runs a particular function in the new thread. We have join, which was kind of like wait PID, except instead of having this weird status, we had just a pointer that thread could return. And we had exit, which is like exit, but for just a thread. We saw some examples of how we could pass values to pthreads, which often seems daunting because you're told you can pass a pointer. What do you do with that? And then we looked at, well, we know about having a thread do something, finish, and then, you know, we collect its results, but often we want to do something a little more fine-grained. So how can we do things that coordinate multiple threads? And to think about that, we first need to say, well, what, you know, happens that can cause two threads to interfere with each other? So we have this notion of atomic operations, that something that's atomic either happens not at all or all at once. We don't have an in-between state that we can observe. And this means that if multiple threads are doing atomic operations, we're not going to have to worry about what if I wrote half of the integer and I read something that's in between the two values. That's not going to be possible if writing the integer is an atomic operation and reading it is an atomic operation. Then we looked at, well, load and store intuitively, you know, we think of numbers being stored together, so those should be atomic. Maybe that's enough to do everything we want. And we learned that maybe technically it is, but practically speaking, our strategy of just storing values and loading values didn't work. And we saw that with our analogy to like writing notes and reading notes. That wasn't enough. We needed a little more from our physical world. And when I finished off last time, I talked about an abstraction we're going to want to provide known as locks. And locks provide what we'll call mutual exclusion. That one thread does a thing. That thing could be like going to the store and buying milk after checking for milk and going to the store and buying milk, or it could be some more useful operation in our programs. And we'll call that operation that's protected by a lock a critical section. That's code which only runs in one thread at a time. So questions about what we covered last time before I move on to talking more about locks? Okay. So we had our notion of a lock, and a lock is our abstraction for providing mutual exclusion or critical sections. So we have this acquire operation, grabs a lock, and waits, you know, after it's free, waits first, and then when you have a lock, no one else can have it. So maybe the analogy to a physical lock isn't right. I'll talk about other analogies later. So our typical usage for a lock is you access some shared resource, like the milk in the fridge. You acquire the lock before you do anything with it. So to make sure only one person buys milk at a time, we acquire the lock, you know, check if there's no milk, and then fix that problem before we release the lock. So we do the whole changing whether there's milk with the lock held, so nothing, no one else will do it at the same time. And we have some concrete implementations of locks that we can use. So pthreads has multiple locks, actually, but the one we're going to use the most is called a mutex. We'll talk about what a mutex is either later today or next time. And this is the interface for a mutex. You declare a mutex variable. You have to initialize it. There's also another way of initializing it we might see sometimes, which is you can set it equal to this special constant, pthread underscore mutex underscore initializer, which is in all caps. You can look this up on the documentation for the manual page for pthread mutex init or pthread mutex lock. We'll show you that. But other, you know, that's one option, or you can call this init function. It takes attributes for the lock, which we mostly won't care about. And there's a lock operation and an unlock operation. There are also spin locks in XV6. This is XV6's primary implementation of the lock abstraction. And it's why I give the names lock or acquire. POSIX calls it lock and unlock. XV6 calls it acquire and release. Sorry, they're the same thing. So in XV6, you declare a variable to represent the lock. You have to initialize it. This code is typically run in some function that runs on boot. And then you can acquire and release. And we saw, you know, an example of this in dealing with the scheduler. We had a lock to make sure only one thing at a time manipulates what programs are runnable. So we have this lock abstraction. I think if you want an analogy to think about what a lock means, you know, is that when we're using a lock, we come to an agreement that there's like a flag. If I'm holding and waving the flag in the air, I can do something. I have access to something, and no one else does. And this only works because we have an agreement. So the lock doesn't actually work like we think of normal locks working, like it doesn't prevent someone from looking in the refrigerator and buying milk. There's just an agreement between Alice and Bob that when Alice has the flag in her hand, that Bob is not going to do that. But there's nothing actually stopping that. And this is true with our locks and our threads. There's nothing stopping you from accessing the shared resource the lock is supposed to prevent you from accessing. You have to write your code so you use the lock and check the lock to do it. So the lock operation in this analogy is wait for the flag to be on the table and then grab it. And the unlock operation is put it back on the table for someone else to grab. And key thing, remember again, is this is a voluntary agreement that all the locks we'll be talking about are not things which enforce the access like locking my door. They're something which, you know, depend on you actually using it. Yeah?
I have a two-step question. So first, what's the, you're actually probably into this in a second, but what's the advantage of not like completely locking the resource?
So the question is, why don't we enforce it? And what's the advantage of that? So typically, there's not an advantage, per se, of that. But it's typically that we don't have mechanisms to actually do that.
Okay.
When we see how locks are implemented, we'll see that the tools we have don't have a way of marking this is the resource directly. We just implement this abstraction sort of independently of how the resource works.
Okay. So would that introduce any cybersecurity bugs?
So does this introduce, like, so the question says introduce security issues. So, like, bugs in general can be introduced from doing locking improperly, and because it's voluntary, you can do it wrong. And you probably will on a future assignment at least once. So, in that sense, yes. So, we have this lock analogy, and I'd like to talk about one thing where you want to use locks where it's maybe not obvious, like, when we need to have this mutual exclusion, one thread at a time. And I'm going to talk about this with C++'s containers library. So C++ has a vector that's a dynamic array, basically. And a question you might have is, I have a vector. I want to use it for multiple threads. Can I do that? And this is kind of actually an annoying question, because normally you just say, this is a dynamic array. I use it like an array, and I don't worry about what is it actually doing under the hood. But now, to answer the question of will it work for multiple threads, I need to know what is it actually doing, you know, what operations are really atomic, and, you know, in particular, like, I might worry about, like, if the array is being reallocated, you know, what's going to happen? Am I going to access the wrong version of the array while it's being reallocated from another thread because I'm not locking and making sure only one person touches the vector while it's changing in size? And you might say, okay, it's a dynamic array. Sometimes the array is resized. Accessing it while the array is being resized could be dangerous because I could access the old array and it could be changed to the new array. So maybe it's safe as long as we're not appending or erasing. That would be a good guess based on a notion that the vector class, when you change its size, it does a reallocation. Otherwise, you're just accessing different parts of the same array, you know, assuming reading and writing each value in the array is atomic, which it usually is, we learned, no problem. But can we really depend on that? Now, for example, it seems like a perfectly sane implementation of this dynamic array would say, I'll expand the array a whole lot, and if it seems like that was too much, I'll shrink it later, just because you waited too long before using that extra space. That seems like a perfectly reasonable decision, and that would wreak havoc on this notion that just because we're not appending to it, we can still access it, because maybe one thread decides to resize it, and I'm accessing it from another, and I get the wrong version. I get access deallocated memory by accident, because I read the pointer to the array, another thread removes it, and oops, have it. Now, the way the C++ standard deals with this, which is similar to how pretty much any library that you want to use for multiple threads needs to work, is that the library authors have written some rules about guarantees they do and do not make. So C++, the standard people recognize maybe it would be useful for you to know when you can use this vector. So they said, okay, we're going to guarantee that we're not going to do things that break it for multiple threads as long as you have some restrictions. And the restrictions that C++ has decided on is that multiple threads can read anything in a container like vector or map or sets or any of the other parts of the C++ standard library at the same time, and they'll guarantee that that will work. That means that they either aren't doing strategies like shrinking it because you haven't written to it for a while, or if they're doing that, they're using locks or something internally. And they're promising, we're going to do that for you so you can use this for multiple threads. And the rule that C++ says is that you can safely add or remove elements from a container if no other threads are accessing it. So that means that you need to use something like a lock to make sure that no other threads are accessing it is true. If you don't do that, they make go guarantees about what's going to happen, because they don't want to do locking that's going to turn out to be expensive for performance all the time. So this is the rules they've defined. And when you see any library you want to use for multiple threads, you need to check. And if you don't have rules like this, well, you probably need to assume you can't do anything for multiple threads safely, just in case they're doing weird things under the hood on operations you think shouldn't change anything. And you really want to check, because sometimes there are weird exceptions. And in fact, the C++ standard library has one. And this is vectors of booleans are not safe to use for multiple threads, basically. And the reason for this, which isn't intuitive, is that C++ wanted to allow implementations to store a vector of bools by putting multiple booleans in one integer. But we know that we're going to read and write the whole integer all at once, so that means it's not safe to write different parts of the vector at the same from different threads. They'll interfere with each other because it's not actual separate integers. And this is not how an array of booleans would work, because they wouldn't store multiple things in one integer. So it's a special case, and you wouldn't know it unless you checked what the authors of the library told you, hey, here are the guarantees we make. Some questions? Yes? Okay, so now that we've sort of gone over high level, let's look at implementing locks. And I'm going to first start with the simplest case for implementing locks, which is a single core. We have a single core, we don't have to worry about threads. And in this case, we need to worry about context switches. We don't want a context switch to happen while we're doing our operation. And Our observation we can make is that how does the context switch happen? We have some sort of interrupt, you know, timer expires, some IO, like a key press, needs to be handled by the OS, and that triggers a context switch. So our solution to implement locks, that's going to be the simplest one, is disable interrupts temporarily. And I mentioned that we did this with the scheduler. You know, so we can just use this to implement locks on a single core in general. This won't work on multiple cores, but on a single core, this seems sufficient. And we, in fact, have instructions to do this on x86, for example, and most architectures have instructions for disable interrupts, re-enable interrupts, precisely to allow us to do this. Now, this is a working way to implement locks, but there are some problems. So what are some problems with this? Where are some cases where if I implemented locks this way on my single core system, you would be unhappy with programs? Yeah.
That blocks any I/O interrupts
as well. So it blocks I/O, and why is that a problem? Yeah, so some program that's using a lock can stop my program that's using the keyboard from responding. Yeah, so that's definitely a problem. Any other issues? Yeah.
If I'm like a jerk or I'm a bad programmer, I can lock and never unlock and just toggle the CPU forever.
Yeah, so I can just hang the system pretty easily. And you're saying I could do this maliciously. I could also do it by accident. Okay. Any other issues? Some other things which might be problematic. So think about things we might want to do while we have a lock held. Yeah. Yeah, so there's some operations we want to do, like say reading from the disk, that we might want to use a lock to have only one thread do it at a time. But now we can't do that because reading from the disk requires an interrupt to be handled, and we've stopped the interrupt. So that's not going to work. Okay. So these are problems I had. We can hang the system. We can't do I/O during the lock because it's just going to wait for an interrupt to flee the I/O. That's never going to happen. There's another more subtle issue, which is that I said that we have like separate locks for different resources. So we have like, you know, say we have our lock for checking for milk and our lock for the store. You know, that's a sensible sort of design, and this doesn't actually work quite with our disable interrupts plan because we re-enable interrupts here and therefore we don't have mutual exclusion anymore for a little bit of code. And that's not a problem in this case, but if we did anything here, it would be. You know, if we did things in a slightly different order, doesn't provide the guarantee we think. So XV6's spin lock does use this disabling interrupt strategy, and their answer to some of these problems, like these two, is, well, this is only going to be accessible in the kernel, so we're assuming the kernel programmers don't do this. They don't hang the system. If they mess up, they're gonna, but that's their problem, not ours. And they assume we don't try to do I/O in the lock in a way which requires interrupts. And they have a solution to this nested locks issue I'll show you in a bit. So one of the things the XV6 spin lock does is it has this push CLI and pop CLI functions. Now, CLI is the name of the instruction for disabling interrupts. So you might wonder what push and pop means. So these are things which appear in pairs. And the way they work is they push CLI is disable interrupts if they are not already, and pop CLI is re-enable interrupts, but only if the paired push CLI disabled them. So this way, when we have nested locks, like here, what we'll end up doing with this, we'll have a push CLI and a pop CLI here, and this disabled, and we'll have another push CLI and another pop CLI here, and since this disabled, the last one is going to enable. But the middle ones just won't do anything except increment a counter to track how many we've had. Questions about that idea? Yes. So why is it helpful to have nested locks? So we might have different resources which need to be protected separately. So in this example, like I have like a very contrived thing of like milk in the store, but so one example that occurs in XV6 is like we have a lock for counting ticks of time, number of timer interrupts, and a lock for the process table. And we can think of when we're doing something like having a process wait for a certain amount of time to pass, we might want both of those locks. Does that answer your question? Okay. So that's that part. So that's disabling interrupts. So that's going to be implementing locks on a single core. So now we need to talk about implementing locks on a multi-core. And we're going to use atomic operations to do this. And we're going to use, as I hinted last time, atomic operations that are more powerful than atomic loads and stores. But before I get to that, I want to mention something about how a thing that atomic operations don't really help with. So I have an example of a race here. So this is some code which is going to have inconsistent results based on that, based on whether or not thread A or thread B runs in different orders. So thread A stores 1 into a global variable X, then copies the variable Y into its return value. Thread B stores 1 into a global variable Y and copies X into its return value. And you would assume that this code means that we have a couple possibilities depending on whether A or B run first. So give me one example of what's a possible return value of thread A and thread B if they run in parallel. And they're both started at the same time, run concurrently, I should say. Like, what's a possible return value of thread A and B? X and Y start at 0. Yeah. So how would they both return 1? Yeah, so on a single core, we might imagine that we run this, then we run this, then we run this, and then we run this. And this means that we have a couple of context switches happening to make that happen. Or in a multi-core, we might imagine multiple cores do that, and that's the order the effects are seen in. Okay. And there's some other possibilities. So you gave the most complicated possibility, I think, because it involves the most switching between the threads. One possibility is we run A, and then we run B. If we run A first, then it's going to return 0 because Y hasn't been set by anything yet. And then we run B, and it's going to return 1 because A set X to 1. So questions about those outcomes. And we have the opposite for B executes first. Okay? So this is what you'd think would happen. And I ran this code on my desktop 100 million times. And here are the results I got. And you might look at this result here and say, wait a moment, did we miss something? How is that possible? Because it looks like something has to be set to 1 before I return, before one of the returns happens. that looks completely impossible, and that happened. And you might say, is my hardware buggy or something? And my hardware is working as documented. So loads and stores are atomic on my machine, but atomic, you know, you would think would say, okay, they just happen, you know, in order, you know, just all together. But that's not what atomic guarantees. Atomic says it happens all at once or not at all. So either we stored one or zero, either we loaded one or zero. That happens. But it doesn't guarantee ordering. And that seems awfully inconvenient for us to implement locks, right? Like, how are we going to reason about what our locks are doing if it turns out that things we thought were happening after the lock won't? And we can see what happens here is that the processor decided, you know, I don't actually need to run that load of Y after storing into X. Don't need to do that. I'm just going to run them in a different order. That's fine. And processors do this because it's faster. So they just take the shortcut, you probably think they shouldn't be allowed to take. Now, you might say, well, doesn't this break normal programs? And the reason it doesn't break single-threaded programs is that on a single thread, on a single core, the processor is going to track the side effects and make sure nothing bad happens that you can observe the reordering on a single core. But they don't go through that effort between cores. So that seems really annoying. You know, and you can understand, like, okay, we're just doing the load faster. That's why they're doing it. So they can do the store later, but still return immediately. That's the advantage, but it sure seems inconvenient. You know, and if they can do this, what can't they do? And x86 and most architectures do have some restrictions on this. They don't just go hog wild with, let's just do things in whatever order we want. So x86 has some rules. I'm not going to have you memorize these rules because it turns out that these rules are incredibly difficult to reason about. But the rules are, each core sees its own loads and stores in order. They might not happen in order, but you'll get the same effects as if they do. The hardware's going to make that happen. And stores from other cores appear in a consistent order, except a core might see their own store early. So you can see the reasoning there is you can cache your own store before it goes out to the other cores. That's the performance gain. They guarantee when it goes out to the other cores, all the other cores see it at the same time. And they have this causality guarantee that if you read something and then write another thing, that other cores are going to see the thing you read before they see the thing you wrote, not the other way around. You aren't going to write something for no reason. This is why that's called causality. So if there's something that some value you read which causes you to write a value, that will be consistent on other cores. So that's kind of useful. And you might say, well, we could like try to reason about what this means for writing normal programs. You know, so we could use these guarantees that the processor designers made for us and try to make it so we can write, you know, all our programs and have them work correctly. But in practice, that's going to be too hard. Like, yes, you can do it, but figuring out, you know, exactly what's allowed and not allowed under these rules is very tricky, and usually we won't do that. So instead, we're going to rely on our processor designers providing us with special instructions. And there's two types of special instructions. So one is that they'll have versions of normal instructions that have strong ordering rules, where they're going to guarantee, no, this is not going to be reordered in some way. And the reason we'll know that it does that is because they'll tell us in the manual, this instruction works this way. And we'll have special instructions that restrict the ordering of other instructions, known as fences. So we'll have a fence instruction which says, don't reorder across this fence. So we can think of, you know, taking all our instructions and putting them in some order. If there's a fence, we can't throw the instruction over the fence to change when we execute it. this is about reordering. So we're going to have to use special instructions. And for implementing locks, this means that we're not going to use normal instructions to implement locks. We're going to have to use these special instructions, or else, you know, we won't be able to reason about what it does. Okay, so questions about processors reordering things? Okay, so I said processors reordering things. Compilers are also a problem. So compilers, like processors, they make sure everything works fine in a single thread. They don't care about what happens in other threads. And we can see this with, you know, trying to write, for example, our code from our Alice and Bob examples. This was the correct version. We said that Alice writes a note. Alice waits until there's no note from Bob. So we wrote our straightforward version with global variables. And, you know, if we didn't have to worry about processor reordering, this seems like it would work. But the compiler has done something really annoying for us. The compiler decided, oh, you have this loop that's checking note from Bob. And, you know, I know it's slow to load a value from a global variable all the time. So I'm just going to put that in a register for you. So it's going to load note from Bob into EAX, that register, and just check that register in the loop instead of checking the global variable. And you might say, the compiler can't do this, but the rules of C and C++ say, yes, it can. And you have to do something special to tell the compiler, no, really, other threads are going on. Don't do things like this. Don't load things early and assume they stay the same. And this is like calling reordering, because the compiler is assuming, I can just load it before the loop. That's good. Do all those loads before the loop. And this sure is faster, but it sure isn't correct. And this happens for example, stores. So let's say I have a variant of this protocol where I have two versions of the note from Alice. Version one is we're waiting. Version two is we're done. And you say, OK, that seems reasonable. And we see that what the compiler here decided to do is it said, oh, you're writing one and then two. Well, that write of one, you're just going to overwrite with two, so I should just get rid of it and just write two at the end. Okay. Compiler decided that's what it should do. You might say, can't do that. Rules of C and C++ say it can. The compiler doesn't have to worry about other threads. If you want the compiler to worry about other threads, you're going to have to add things to do that. So you might say, after all this discussion, how do I ever do anything safely with multiple threads in C and C++? So I mentioned we have some special instructions that will let us do this. And the pthreads functions that you want to use all run those special instructions, and they tell the compiler, hey, don't do this nasty thing of not assuming there are other threads. So when you use pthread create and pthread join, or pthread mutex lock, those all contain the appropriate extra instructions and stuff to tell the compiler, hey, knock it off. I want things to work like I expect with multiple threads. Just as far as, you know, making sure things don't get reordered, or, you know, things don't get kept in registers and so on across those calls to pthread functions. And the compiler also has things that let you access the processor functionality more directly. So in recent versions of C++, there's an atomic header, which gives you access to what they call atomic operations, but these can prevent compiler reordering and CPU reordering. So they're wrappers around those special instructions I mentioned. So, and this is an alternative to handwriting assembly code and figuring out how to tell the compiler this assembly code you shouldn't do weird things with. So for example, if I want to tell the compiler, no, really, keep loading note from Bob every time, I can put in this special call to a fence And that will do two things. So one thing it will do is the compiler will realize, oh, you have this special call. I shouldn't keep note from Bob loaded in the register. Compiler will know that because it knows what this does, and it knows that I'm trying to deal with multiple threads. So it and it also will generate this special instruction to say, hey, processor, don't reorder things. Like, stop reordering things across this instruction, which is this mFence instruction. Okay, so questions? Yeah.
Why is this something we write in C code instead of a compiler option?
So the question is, why is this something you would write in C++ instead of a compiler option in general? So the main reason is that most of your code, you don't want to be doing this. Most of the time, you want the compiler to like keep things in registers and so on. So the idea is you annotate the rare exceptions. Yes?
Where are the boundaries of the fence?
Question is, where are the boundaries of the fence? So the fence is a single operation which says that things that executed before the fence need to finish before things that after the fence happen. Does that make sense? Yeah, so the fence is finish everything up before you do anything after this fence. That's what the fence says. Okay. Now, the C++ atomic header also has ways of doing store and load, and these, in addition to doing an atomic load and store, which we learned normally we already have, they also have the compiler insert the appropriate synchronization instructions so the hardware doesn't do reordering of the load and store. So in this case, I store one into note from Alice, and we have a fence here to make sure that that store happens before we load note from Bob. And you might say, don't we need something to keep this from loading? But it turns out that we can just read note from Bob with that instruction directly, and as long as we're not reading from a register or anything, the processor will keep checking memory. So that's fine. And the compiler just knows this. That's why it generated this assembly. So it knows that that load will keep checking the real memory value, and it generated that code because we said, load from memory for real, I'm using multiple threads. Now, I've shown you this code. We will not write code using the atomic header. I want you to know it exists. In case you need to do this, you have a way of doing it. We're instead going to use the higher level abstractions of like the pthreads library and so on. But we're going to talk about this because those have to be implemented somehow, and it's this kind of mechanism that's going to implement them. So questions about our atomic things before I move on? Okay. So I mentioned that this is not a default behavior, not a compiler option, because we want to do this rarely. And part of why we want to do this rarely is that that mFence instruction is surprisingly expensive. So on Skylake, it takes around 33 cycles. The time in which you could do hundreds of additions to do that. So we don't want to do that all the time. So now that we know about how our hardware interfaces, let's talk about what's the hardware doing under the hood. How does it the case that we have multiple processors accessing the same memory? How does that work? And we want to know about this because this is going to affect how we know how the processors are going to allow us to coordinate. And I'm going to start with the simplest model for how we connect multiple processors together to memory, is that we have a shared bus. So all the processors are connected to a single line of communication, and anyone can send anything on that line, and they have to take turns. I'm not going to show how they take turns, but they're going to need to take turns. So there's going to be some hardware which enforces that one goes at a time. And since CPU1 might be sending something to memory1, memory one has to know it's for them, so the messages are going to say who they're for. They're going to be tagged to say this is for this person, even though everyone can see them because they're all connected to the same communication line. Okay, so questions? This design, and I have CPUs, I mean like cores for. Now, this is not necessarily what you use, because it doesn't scale to too many CPUs. We're gonna like gloss over that issue and just work with the shared bus, because the same principles are gonna apply to the better solutions. Now, with this model here, it looks like every time I want to access a value in memory, I need to send a message on the shared bus and go all the way to memory, but that's slow. And it's especially slow if we have contention, right? That means that we can only go, no matter how many cores we have the same speed to memory. That seems bad. And our typical solution for that in hardware is caches. Now, hopefully, you've seen vaguely caches in some prior course. And remember, the idea of caches is memory is slow. We want to have local copies of memory. But this is going to be a problem with our multiple cores. And our problem is that multiple CPUs are going to be accessing the same memory. And we saw that with all the examples I've shown earlier to show like reordering and keeping things in the same order and so on, we have multiple cores accessing like the same value in a global variable. And the question is, how does that work with caches? So here, I have two CPUs. They have caches. They're on the CPU because that's closer, it's faster. It's what we want to do. And these two CPUs have address A300 both cached. And they have the same value, so there's no problem. But where we do run into a problem is what happens when CPU1, say, decides to write that value. So the program running there modifies the global variable at that address. How do we make CPU2 update its version of the value? And in particular, we want to do this in a way which isn't going to involve actually going to memory every time we write a value, because that's really inefficient. That would kind of get rid of a lot of the reason to have caches in the first place if we still have to go to memory all the time. So questions? This idea. So our implementation is going to be based on this shared bus, and we're going to take advantage of something really nice about this shared bus. And that's that every processor already knows how memory is being updated. So if we want to tell every processor that a value is being modified, we can do it at the same time as we tell memory the value is being modified. So we're going to use this to clean up the bad cache entries. And this property means that the simplest thing we could do is we could just say all our caches are write through, meaning that whenever we modify a value in them, we write that value to memory. And that would solve this problem. That we could say, okay, this happens, I'm going to write, A300 equals 1001, tell memory one that, and our CPU2 is going to listen in. This is snoop, is as we'll call it, and know to edit that value. So that would be the simplest thing we could do. But the problem with that is that means we have to have write-through caches, and that would be really slow. So we're going to want something based on this principle, based on the fact that this works, but that avoids sending values to the bus all the time that isn't really slow. So to do this, we're going to keep a little extra information for every cache block. And we're going to store this in the cache. So along with the value we're storing, we're going to also store this little bit of extra information. And we're going to update this extra information based on what we hear on the bus and what the program does. And this is going to be separate for every cache. So we might have a different set of information on CPU1 and CPU2 for the same part of memory. And basically, we're going to say that each block, each set of piece of data we're keeping in our cache is going to be in one of three states. We're going to call one of the states modified. So modified means that there's a value I'm storing, and it might be different than memory, and I'm the only one who has it. So this means, this is where we're deviating from that write-through policy. So this says that we're allowing us to have what we call a dirty value, a value that is no longer in sync with memory, but we have this extra constraint that we're going to enforce that I am the only one who has this new value. And we're going to enforce that through how we update these states on all the processors. We'll have a shared state, which is I have a value, and it's the same value that's in memory. And as the name shared implies, we're not going to say I'm the only one who has it. Multiple cores could have the same shared value. And that's 100% okay. And we have an invalid state, which is I don't have this value. I need to ask for it. This is the same as it's not in my cache. So questions about these states? Yeah. So the question is, this can't be stored in one bit? No. So we're going to need at least two bits to do this. If you remember, if you took a version of caches where we talked, where you talked about dirty and valid bits, this can overlap exactly with the dirty and valid bits. Yes?
Does invalid mean null?
Does invalid mean null? Invalid means the value isn't present in the cache. You can call that null if you want. It's the same as, like, I never loaded it. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
The problem I'm struggling with right now is it seems like you're going to have the same problem when you're changing like a certain bit for one processor. It's the same cache, but for a processor. How do other processors know? Yeah.
So your question is, it looks like I'm not saving any time because I still have to send everything to the bus. And let's look at when I have to do that to figure out where I'm saving. So here's a diagram of saying I'm in invalid, shared, or modified, and what do I do if I want to read or to write? We also have a column for here read that some other processor sends a read, what do I do about it? Some other processor sends a write. But we'll first worry about what do I do if I read? So if I read from invalid, I go to shared. So that's the same as before. If I write from invalid, I go to modified. Does that make sense? Now, if I read from shared, I do nothing. So that's the same as our naive write-through scheme. You know, if I have the value cached, I don't need to ask anyone about it. So that seems fine. And if I read from modified, I don't do anything. So that's the same. Now, if I write from the shared state, I go to modified, and I have this highlighted in blue because I have to send some message to other processors. So it seems like I'm not saving there. And that's probably your main complaint, is that, gosh, I have a value loaded, I'm writing, I still need to send a message out that I wouldn't need to send otherwise. But where we have our savings is here. If I write a value, overwrite a value of already written, I don't need to do anything. So like if I have a counter, the first time I update the counter, I need to tell everyone, hey, I'm updating the counter. After I tell everyone I'm updating the counter, I'm not going to tell them again. And that's where we're going to get a big savings. Okay. Some questions? Now, to make this work, we need to do some things, you know, to keep the other processors up to date. So one of them is that whenever I write a value, even if I have the old value cached, I need to tell everyone about it the first time, when I first modify it, make it modified. And the reason for that is that if someone else is storing this value, that they need to know that they can't have it anymore. Because remember, modified means I'm the only one who has it. So they need to hear that we're writing the value and go to the invalid state. But if we already have it in the modified state, we know that no one else has the value, so we don't need to tell them about it. So it's fine. Oh, and this should not be highlighted in blue. Okay, so tell anyone. Also, if someone else wants to read the value while we have a modified version, we need to make sure they don't read an out-of-date version. Because remember, the shared state says, I have the current version of the value. And we need to make that true. So if we hear someone reading and we have a modified version, we need to update memory so they can read it. So this is, you know, discard to give someone exclusive access. And this is update everyone else with the new version, because they're reading. Okay, so question, yes?
If you have the modified value, when you really hear a write, shouldn't all the other cores have given you the exclusive access?
So the question is, would you hear a write if you have the modified value? So you have exclusive access now, but someone might want to write the value out of the blue. So they aren't reading it in advance. They're just saying, set this variable to 10. You know, so they'll send a set variable to 10 on the bus, and you need to deal with that. Does that answer your question? So that's not common that they'll be writing it without reading what you did, but that could happen. So part of discarding the value, part of discarding the value, you know, if modified, write back first. If I'd update everyone. So if you're modified, you're going to send any of your updates to memory before they do their write. Does that answer your question? And why would that matter might be a good question. And the reason it will matter is that we can store multiple, like, array elements in one cache block. Okay, other questions? Okay, so, yeah, some examples. So for writing while shared, we have to send the write to inform other people in the shared state, hey, I need exclusive access to this, so they can invalidate it. If we hear a write while we're shared, we need to invalidate, so they can modify the value without telling us any more about how they're modifying it. And if we write my modified, this is where we're getting our big savings. We're not telling anyone about it. So to give an example, this, let's say, you know, I have my original example, and I write value 101. We're going to send, hey, I'm writing this value to on the bus. We're going to update memory. And we're also going to tell CPU 2, hey, I'm updating this value. It's going to get rid of its copy. Doesn't do anything because it was shared, so it knows it doesn't need to tell anyone about changes to that value. And later on, now we can increment that value again to 102 and don't need to tell anyone, you know, because we know if they read, they'll tell us on the bus and we'll handle it then. Okay. So later on, if there's a read, we'll say, oh, gosh, I have an update for you, let me get that for you, and we'll send it back before that read finishes. Okay, so we'll get the right value. So questions? This approach? So I mentioned that one way in which this saves over our naive write everything immediately strategy is that when we're writing values we've already written, we don't need to tell anyone. Another way we can save on this is that I can just say, I'm writing a value without sending the new value. So I can just say, I'm updating this value without actually sending the new data. And this is commonly done in the real implementations of this because, you know, it saves a lot of time not actually sending the updated values. Okay, so questions? Okay, so since we've talked about this, let's do a little exercise. So I have two CPUs, and we're using this protocol. Initially, there's nothing in the cache, so everything's invalid. And I have 32-byte blocks and 8-byte reads and writes. So they don't overlap two blocks, which would be really annoying. And this is the sequence of things that happen. Question is, what's the final state of the block with address 1000 and 2000? And with 32-byte blocks, you can assume the first block is 0 through 32, or 0 through 20 in hex. The second is 20 through 40, and so on. So there's a cache block that starts at address 1000 to 1020, you know, exclusive of the end. And the same with 2000. So I'll give you a minute to look this out, check with your neighbor. So, anyone have answers for me here? Someone want to give me any one answer at the bottom? Any one of them. Yeah. So you're saying for question one, these are both shared. So how did that happen? Okay, so I'll go through. So I say they start off invalid. CPU 1 reads address 1000. So that means the cache block 1000 through 101F, that's 32 bytes unless I'm miscounting, which is very possible, becomes shared on CPU 1 and is still invalid on 2 and 3. Then CPU 2 does the same thing, so it becomes shared on 1 and 2. We're allowed to have two things in the shared state. That's fine. Then CPU 1 writes to that. So remember, we go to this modified state on writes, and modified means no one else can have a copy. So everyone else's copy becomes invalid. And I can ignore the operations that don't involve that first cache block, so I'm going to. So then CPU 2 reads 1000. That doesn't change anything. It can read it from the modified state without doing anything. So we're going to do the laziest possible thing. Then CPU 3 tries to read it. This is CPU 3, tries to read it. So that means it's going to need to get a copy. And we're going to go into the shared state. But CPU 1 has a modified version it needs to update. And notice that even though we're reading a different value than was written, We only keep track of the whole cache block, so we don't care that a different value is written. So we're going to go into the shared state on CPU 1. So I don't think CPU 2 is invalid. CPU 2 I don't think has the value anymore, but CPU 3 has it in shared. So questions about, did there, yes. Oh, that's what I missed. I can't read numbers, namely the two. Yes, so this gets it into the shared state, so they're all in shared. Sorry, I read it as CPU 1 reads a value, but the CPU 2 reads, so when CPU 2 reads, we do the same transfer I said happened later. Does that help? Sorry, thank you for catching that. I should be able to read 1, 2, and 3. Okay, so they all end up shared because they've all, every processor, you know, one CPU 1 wrote to that cache block and every other processor read from it. So they all have a shared copy from after that write. And for the 2000, CPU 1 reads it, that becomes shared. CPU 2 writes it, that reads it. I should write over here. CPU 1 reads it. Becomes shared, but CPU 2 writes it, which invalidates CPU 1's copy. Even though, so this is modified, and this is invalid. Okay, so questions? How this works? So, something to note, so I gave you a very simple way of keeping things in sync. This is something which real processors have used, this approach. Commonly, there are extensions that are more efficient. So one thing that's more efficient is separating the tracking of modifications from whether other caches have a copy. Here, we kind of put those two together. We said it's modified and other caches don't have a copy. We could say it's not modified and other caches don't have a copy. We can send values directly between caches. Here I've said we have to write to memory. But there's an approach where we send the values directly between caches, which is a little faster. And we can do this same thing without a shared bus, and that obviously changes a whole bunch of how it has to work. Okay. So something about this that coming up in this exercise is that when we read and wrote different parts of the cache block, it affected the state of the whole cache block. So for example, when CPU 2 wrote to the latter part of this 2000 cache block, it meant that CPU 1 couldn't keep a value cached. Because we only allow one writer for the whole cache block, we don't track subparts of the cache block because that would be extra stuff to track. And this happens in real processors. And in real processors, our typical memory access is way smaller than a cache block. So a cache block on a typical processor these days is around 64 bytes or so, plus or minus. And if two different processors modify different parts of the cache block, they have to take turns accessing the value, which means that we lose the advantage of keeping the value in the cache because we have to send things on that shared bus. I mentioned we had this whole fancy modified thing to avoid that. Doesn't work when we have two things accessing different parts of the same cache block. And I can demonstrate this in some code. You can see the performance difference is actually pretty real, and you can see it. So here I have code which sums up a big array into a variable that is passed by a pointer. So this is how I'm going to run in threads. And I'm going to run two of these at a time. And sometimes they're going to be accessing a variable that's in the same cache block as the other thread. And sometimes they're not. And if they're in separate cache blocks, we don't have to say, hey, I have the only copy of this whole block. I have the only copy. I only have the copy, and flop back and forth. And if they don't have the same, if they do have the same cache block, we'll do that. If they don't, they'll be independent, and we won't use the shared bus, and things should be a lot faster. And here, I have a function which does that, and we just choose how far away the values are. So if they're further than the size of a cache block, then we'll see the effect of it being faster. And when I run this, that's in fact what I get. So here's the distance between the values in array element in bytes, and the performance in cycles. And we can see I have 64-byte cache blocks on my machine. Like, read it off the chart. And before, and when, on those smaller sizes, we had this one processor got it in the modified state, sent a message on the bus, another processor sent a message on the bus, and that made things like 40% slower or something. Okay, so questions about how this worked? So this phenomenon is known as false sharing. So we have two independent values, which don't really interfere with each other, but they're part of some bigger thing, in this case, a cache block, so we get bad performance. And our solution to make avoid this is to separate them. And this is something which sometimes happens by accident in programs. So in this case, you know, the way it would happen by accident is our two threads update adjacent array elements because we said, oh, I need two results from these different threads. Let me get two different array elements for that and just pass them right next to each other. And we do that, that would be a sensible choice, and we get bad performance. And our solution to fix this is to separate them by adding useless padding. Like, just add useless space. And that's really the solution to this problem. Even though that seems wasteful at a glance. Yes?
Is that what the align thing does, or is it?
So the question is, why did I have this align thing in the code? This is just to ensure that array 0 is at the beginning of a cache block. So if I didn't do that, I'd see the same effect, but the size wouldn't tell me the size of a cache block. I might, array 0 might be in the middle of a cache block already. Is that so your question? Okay. So now that we know how cache coherency works and how it doesn't work, this false sharing problem, that sometimes it synchronizes things that we don't want, we can talk about special instructions. And I mentioned atomic load and store, what we've seen so far, not good enough. We really want what's called a read, modify, write operation. We want one instruction that atomically reads and modifies and writes a value. And now we know that that's actually pretty easy for the processor to implement. How does the processor implement it? It reads something into the cache in the modified state and modifies the value in the cache. So we say we're writing the value, get it into our cache, modified state, modified in the cache, we know no one else has it, that's safe. So that's how processors can provide this for us efficiently. And that means that processors have a lot of flexibility with which operations they provide. And that means I'm going to go through a bunch, but I'm going to start with probably the simplest one, which I'll call atomic exchange. So this is an instruction in x86. We read from a location in memory and swap it with a register value. And this is atomic, so this happens without other processors getting in the way, so we know that it changed from between the two values. Okay, so questions? This? And we're going to use this to implement a lock. And the way we're going to do it is we now have an instruction that writes a value, a fixed value that we supply as part of the instruction, like in a register in this case, and reads the old value. So what we're going to do to implement a lock is we're going to write that the lock is taken. So we're going to have a memory location storing representing the lock, which is going to say it's taken or it's not taken. The flag's on the table or it's not. And when we do that write, we're going to update it to taken, and we're going to find out, was it taken before we did that? If the answer is yes, then yes, it's taken, but not because we took it. Someone else took it before us, and we know we can't have this lock operation succeed yet. We have to wait for something to happen. And if it wasn't taken before, we know we got it, we were the first one to get it, it's great. Okay. So questions? This idea. So we can implement what's called a spin lock with this. So here's my spin lock. So first, I store my taken value, which I'm going to use 1 for. And read the old value. Then I check, hey, what value did I read? Did I read the taken value? And if yes, I go back to the beginning and try again. So I just keep trying until I get to take it. So if we think of a flag on the table, I'm grabbing out the table and looking and see, did I get it? And I keep grabbing until I get it. Okay. Questions? How that works? So we also have to unlock the lock. So our release operation is to set the lock to 0, to the not taken value. So when someone next tries to take it, they'll say, oh, it wasn't taken before. And I have a little bit of bookkeeping here that I need to say, hey, don't reorder memory operations. So I use mFence to do that on the release. And it turns out that this atomic exchange instruction also acts as a fence, so I don't need to add an additional one on the lock. And this will behave correctly if called from like compiler code. Okay. Yeah.
Would there be a race condition if we had two things waiting to acquire the lock?
Question is, would there be a race condition if we had two things waiting to acquire the lock? And the answer is no, because the hardware makes this guarantee for us. That lock instruction reads the value, all at once, reads and writes the value all at once. So only one processor can see that it was previously 0. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? So this is basically how the XV6 spin lock is implemented. So the XV6 spin lock is disable interrupts, which we talked about before, and do that loop. Here they do it with a in C, but there's a function that has that special assembly instruction, that lock exchange. And then they have something to tell the compiler, hey, really don't reorder stores, please. Don't reorder loads and stores. And the unlock is similar. They just store 0 after saying, hey, please don't reorder loads and stores. Okay, so questions about that? So it's basically the same as that lock code I showed you. Questions? So atomic exchange is one possible atomic operation, and there are a lot of them. So we saw atomic exchange. Some processors have the particular use of atomic exchange I just showed you, of setting the value to 1 and reading the old value as test and set as a separate instruction. And there's also some more complicated atomic instructions that are commonly implemented. So one is this compare and swap, which says if it's equal to an old value, set it to a new value and tell me you did that. Otherwise, don't do anything. Or fetch and add, which reads the old value, adds to it, tells you what the old value was. And these are atomic, meaning like our atomic exchange, no other processor is going to interrupt us. That if fetch and add returns 10, that means, and we added 5, that means we changed it from 10 to 15, no one else got in the middle of that. No matter how many other people are trying to access the value. And these atomic operations are useful to do things directly if you wanted to do that. So we may or may not talk about that next time. And next time we'll talk about, well, spin locks seem to have some problems, and we'll talk about how we can do better than that, and also talk about other types of synchronization.